We made this. A podcast all about the Marvel Cinematic Universe for the We Made This podcast network. I am your guest host this week, Tony Black, and today we'll be diving into the fourth episode of the Disney Plus series Loki, The Nexus Event. And I'm joined by another fellow co-host, somebody far more seasoned in the world of Podcast 616, than me, and someone I'm sure, listeners, you'll all have been looking forward to hearing from again. It's WandaVision's co-host, Kurt North. How are you, mate?
I'm all right. I'm not too bad. I've got my prune juice and I'm ready to go. So
poor Mobius. We'll get to this. Okay, we'll get to this.
Yeah.
But before we talk about this episode, why don't we just talk both of us about what we've thought about Loki? Because obviously, you know, we've had the brilliant Mark Adams, the awesome Carpenter Lockwood, the extra brilliant, I'm trying to think of adjectives here, Luke Winch. You're all extra brilliant. And various guests on, but obviously we haven't been on yet. So
we haven't.
We've seen four episodes. We've seen three before this. What are your general thoughts overall about Loki, Kurt?
Well, just before I actually say that, one thing I want to mention, which I was lucky enough not to do because I've been really busy recently, is I didn't listen to the primer. And I didn't know anything about Lady Loki at all. So right. luckily, I bypassed that, and that was a nice little adventure to me. I've really enjoyed it. I've, in behind the scenes, and potentially, I haven't really mentioned it on Twitter too much, but I didn't enjoy the Falcon and Winter Soldier at all. It wasn't for me, really. You know, behind the scenes, you know, I think I've become the Wanda fanatic. So, but yeah, it's I didn't really enjoy that.
The Elizabeth Olsen fanatic. Come on, let's get this right.
Yeah, yeah. Just too many gifts of Elizabeth Olsen or Wanda or whatever may well take my fancy on that day. But but regards to Loki, it's much more in my wheelhouse. I've really enjoyed all three episodes up until this one. I think they've been really good. I enjoyed the first one probably the most so far up until episode three. It has that very kind of Doctor Who. It had a bit of Snowpiercer in there last week. It has, you know, that timey-wimey stuff. And I think what's added to, even though I was joking about the Lady Loki stuff, you know, the fact that I didn't listen to that podcast, but it's been nice to listen to some of the deep depths of the comic book stuff that likes of Carpenter and that have been talking about, because I'm not versed in that at all. So I'm not coming from that point of view. So that's been really interesting. But yeah, I've really enjoyed it. I thought the comedy in the first episode was fantastic. I thought that the way that the show's kind of developed and gone in different directions, you're not quite sure where it's going, I think was really good. And the scope of it is really, really interesting. And then we move into this episode, and this episode is particularly interesting. I think it's a lot darker with some of the concepts which have already been alluded to and been mentioned, but this one really digs down into it. So yeah, overall, I've absolutely really enjoyed Loki this past 3 or 4 weeks.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, because yeah, you weren't the biggest fan of Falcon and Winter Soldier, and I, you know, they've swung from very different show to very different show, you know, partly because of COVID. I think you might correct me here, but I'm pretty sure it was supposed to be Falcon and Winter Soldier, WandaVision, then Loki.
Yeah, so I think it was, yeah.
From two fairly whimsical kind of shows back to back, even though they're different in style. I quite like it, actually, that we had a breakwater of something a little bit more serious, I guess, in many ways. But these things aren't for everyone, so it's nice. It's nice to hear that you're back on the train for Loki, which is, I mean, that's the thing. It's definitely not the same as WandaVision. It doesn't have the aspect of surrealism about WandaVision, even though by the end of that show it kind of became a little bit more aligned with what Marvel tend to usually do, Loki's a bit more... Well, I mean, it trades heavily on Tom Hiddleston, doesn't it? It really does trade on that character and that actor in that role. And, you know, I think if Hiddleston hadn't been the revelation, you know, on Tumblr and all these kind of places that he has been, you know, I'm not sure Loki would ever have really maybe got his own show or his own movie in another sort of circumstance. I don't really think we would have had this. I think it's one of those, and this isn't a bad thing by any means, but it's one of those shows that sort of birthed around the performance, and they've really, I think they've created something very good with it. Yeah, I am enjoying it myself. You know, for me, the second episode, The Variant, the best one. Even now, I would say it's still slightly my favourite. This week's is very good, but The Variant had some wonderful, you know, philosophical discussions about time travel. You know, as you know, Kurt, I'm a big sucker for time travel, so that was the main reason I wanted to talk about Loki.
Yeah, I mean, even myself, you know, we're both in that kind of wheelhouse of I like a good kind of show or movie that has a concept, and this is a concept, you know. So it's the fact that it's based around that, as you say, WandaVision's a bit more whimsical and has allusions to this, which I'm sure I'll talk about. I'll end up talking about Wanda in some way, you can guarantee it.
Oh yeah,
as we get into this. But
it's your contractual obligation by this point on podcast 616, I think.
Absolutely. But I do like the concept, and I do like this idea of a sacred timeline and what the ramifications are for it. So the fact that, as you say, but it's both in our wheelhouse for that, I think it's going to be interesting the next two episodes, especially.
Yeah, no, it is. It is really. Which I think is a good place for us to move on and talk about the Nexus event, the fourth episode. Let's give it a rating out of 10 to start with then. So where would you place this? Is this the best episode of the season for you? What number would you put on this one?
I think it is my favourite so far, and I would place it at a solid 9 out of 10 for me. I think there's so much depth that I think we will not touch upon, and I think it'll be for like another review, but there's so much in this, I think, that's kind of coalesced around what we've seen before, and I think it's really kind of getting to the nitty gritty of loads of things. Like I know that like some Marcus talked about this, about identity, about stuff, but then it's kind of taken it a little bit further in my eyes as well, so which we'll talk about shortly. But yeah, definitely a solid 9 out of 10 for me.
Yeah, I would probably say I'd agree it's a 9 out of 10 in the context of Loki as a show. I think as an episode of TV, I think I'd go for about an 8 out of 10 personally. That's not to say that it's bad, but it is, for me, easily the second best episode of the season so far. I think I understand why, for most people, it is the best one. I am skirting that. I just think I like The Variant slightly more for what it was doing with Mobius and Loki, you know, some of the zipping around time, some of the aspects of that. I think I really dig that. I really, really enjoyed that one. But there isn't much in it. And this, I mean, it has that kind of sweep of a season finale, you know, in this episode. And you know, it builds to a fantastic place, and it has so much going on. There's lots and lots of different, you know, strands to it, Nexus events, if you like. And it's really good. It's a really propulsive hour of TV, I think, or 40-odd minutes or whatever. And it really sets the show up for a slightly different swerve in the next couple of episodes, which fits really, because, like, you know, you said earlier that this has a very Doctor Who sort of flavour to it, a whimsical Doctor Who flavour to it, and that's exactly what it is. You know, like, you can definitely see the inspirations throughout this entire show, and that show very much wibbles and wobbles and ebbs and flows and goes off in different directions within storylines. So, you know, the breadth of what Loki's covering, especially in this episode, is really good, and it's confident. And I can see why people maybe are digging this one a bit more than The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, to be honest, even though I did really enjoy that show.
Yeah, well, I can't comment because I didn't get past episode 3, but that's another story.
Well, you haven't even finished it, really?
I didn't even finish it, no. I am going to finish it. I don't want, like, the hate mail, you know, within the first 20 minutes of me on here. But I am going to finish it. I just found it, well, we're not going into too much detail, but I just found it laborious. I thought some of the themes in it was really, really good, but I found the actual pacing of it too slow for me. And it probably sped up in episode four. So.
Well, I do think the second half of that season is better than the first, actually. That is something I think I said at the time. So I would encourage you to go back to it eventually. But it is each to their own. And stylistically, I think, you know, you're gonna find people who loved this. And, you know, Miss Marvel isn't going to be their thing. But then you're going to find people who can't be doing with maybe WandaVision and the whimsy or even any of this before. And then Miss Marvel, for instance, will be. So, you know, the joy of the MCU right now is that it has lots of strings to its bow. And that is, for me, the sign of a really good franchise that is able to do very different things and do them well, you know, and do them individually while still retaining its own sense of self. And I think Loki is... he's a good example of that so far.
Yeah, no, I would totally agree with that. I think that the Marvel Universe is, it will be interesting in years to come how people get into it, because it seems to be very much of a now, you have to be in it now, you know, so it's like from the beginning. And it'll be interesting in years to come once some of the dust has settled in 50 years' time, the way they're going at the moment, how people start their journey with it, because there's hours upon hours upon hundreds of hours now. Of television and films, so that in itself will be worth seeing in the future. But yeah, as I say, I will be watching Falcon Winter Soldier once my emotions have died down a little bit on it, and you know, I can see it with a bit more of a cold eye. So
hey, no, there's no like peer pressure here. You know, you watch when you're ready. You know?
Oh, I will. Don't you worry, Tony.
I tell you what, though, you make an interesting point there, though, about the MCU. In that, I wonder, will it be like the comics themselves, in that you will have points, you know, assuming this goes on for another 10, 20 years, and in theory, it could. This could end up being the longest running franchise ever in movie history. Let's assume it does. Will you have people who jump on at after Endgame, and they'll come on at this point for Phase 4 or whatever, and they'll start from this point, where it is in some respects a newish story with just... because that's what it's like in the comics, you know, you'll get start on points, and then there are little embers of things that happened before, but they almost like, not quite reboot, but they give people an entryway. And I do wonder if that'll be the case with Marvel, if it continues on, because actually you might be able to say, okay, WandaVision, maybe that's where you start, or say something like Spider-Man Far From Home, you know, just after Endgame, maybe that's the point you jump on, and then you go with this story. I don't know, I think that's great. I think that's a really fun way of approaching it, as opposed to it being like just tons and tons of content that you just don't know where to start. And it will be different. It will be different for them watching it first time round, won't it? Because we're in the middle of all the revelations and all the twists. You know, it's almost like people watching Lost for the first time round now. Won't be the same as how we experienced it.
No, I would just on another note as well. We were talking in our XCast behind the scenes XCast group about the mythological aspects of that show. And Carl and I were talking about the fact that there were big sweepstakes, obviously in Novembers and wherever for the, when it was on TV. But for us over in the UK, it was like the VHS of that three-part episode was coming out. And it was like, you're waiting for that episode. And that no longer happens because, you know, WandaVision isn't even on DVD yet, and it probably won't be.
I don't think
the way
gonna.
That they're talking about
it. I think they've said they're not going to do it, haven't they? Really? Yeah. They're not going to release them, so... Yeah,
so that's a completely different tack to what we used to do. What is interesting, I know they were talking about this last week on Podcast 616, is the whole going back to a week on week episode rather than have it all dumped in once. So it seems to be like the format is being played around with quite significantly. But like Star Trek Picard as well, that came out in January 2019, I think it was, and it didn't come out on DVD in the UK until a year and a bit later, which going back to the olden days of like not seeing something for 18 months. So, yes, it's really interesting how like Disney have kind of, and it doesn't surprise me if I'm being honest with Disney, because, you know, I've worked in the cinema industry for a long time. I know what Disney are like. So if you wanted to say, put Beauty and the Beast on just on a random day in August, they would say, no, there's no schedule for releasing that film at that time. And you couldn't physically put it on. So Disney are very kind of controlling, monopolising over their IP really with stuff, which is, so it doesn't really surprise me, even though there is actually money to be made in DVDs. I think it's the subscription stuff that's going to keep them rolling.
Yeah, I think they know that. I think they know that, you know, it's not, all the you know, the restriction of films and Blu-rays isn't necessarily a good thing, don't get me wrong, but I think they know where the bread's buttered. And I think they know that these kind of franchises and how people are, you know, I mean, it's the discourse now. Every week when you've watched these Marvel shows so far, and Loki is no exception, people are discussing on the web and they're talking about it on Twitter and all these platforms. And it's great. That's exactly what you want.
Yeah.
That is how these things build up, and it's all part of the fun of it. You know, this kind of what we're doing is all part of the fun of it. So,
yeah.
You know, we wouldn't be doing this in the same way, this podcast, if they all came out at once. We wouldn't be able to. So that's the beauty of it. So, long may it continue. Long may Disney restricting their films not continue. But that's a different topic.
Yeah.
So let's talk the Nexus event then. So it begins, doesn't it, with a flashback to Sylvie entering the TVA when she's a girl, when she's taken from Asgard. So we get confirmation here that she is definitely is from Asgard, and we don't yet quite know if she's the character Lady Loki. It's very more towards her being the Enchantress, I think, you know, for various reasons from the comics. Given that they're specifically using the word enchant,
Sylvie. Yeah, quite a lot. Yeah,
even though she is a Lady Loki, she is a Loki. She's sort of, I think she's an amalgam of both. You know, over these last two episodes, I think they're sort of wedging two characters together for this, which makes sense, I think, really, in the grand scheme of it.
Yeah, I think that's what they're doing. Again, with the comics, that people expect one thing and they're quite happy to change it and do it a different way, similar to the way Walking Dead do. You know, there's characters in The Walking Dead that are in the comic that aren't in the comic, and what you know, Norman Reedus's character is like wasn't even in the comic at all. And I think it's good that they do that, because I think that, you know, for me, I'm not a comic book reader, so I don't know what's coming, or, you know, until the Enchantress, all I knew about that was what's being said on the podcast. So it's new to me, but I can see it, you know, and obviously comics are very kind of fluid anyway with the way that they control stuff. And I do like that the TV and the universe itself in this media, like they play around with that a little bit. And I do feel that Sylvie is kind of like the amalgamation. We might well find that she becomes that, you know, and just ascends to that kind of thing. So, which would be interesting. What I really liked about this opening scene is the way that it mirrors what happened to Loki in the beginning, but it does it in a way that's a lot more deep and dark. It's like, it's got like the really low angle, Dutch angle of the guy who writes the whatever people say to them. And it's got this real ominous music behind it. And then you've got when it flicks over, you've got the camera looking at Sylvie as a child looking down on her, so it's like sort of a power move of like physically looking at her, and then everything that she goes through is harrowing, whereas everything Loki went through is kind of like almost jovial, you know. So I really like the interplay that they've done there, and it keeps pushing back on in my head about this kind of feeling of like immigration or control over people, and the way that they're really pushing this kind of like dark underbelly of like, you know, the stripping people of their life and being, you know, kind of like the B-15 and C-20s of this world, that they were those variants and their lives have been taken away from and they're being controlled. And I think this really pushes the way it does it with Sylvie. It pushes that idea of like almost like immigration, taking over a child and taking them away from the family kind of thing. And I just feel that whole aspect of giving Sylvie that darker story compared to Loki really does mirror that really well.
Yeah, it's a good point about the immigration aspect. You know, the darkness of a child being taken, you know, plucked away by, you know, quote unquote, you know, the government, if you like, even though the TVA aren't that, but it is this force that are coming in and removing a child, rendition of a child. From in this case a timeline, definitely has that authoritarian, you know, stroke to it, which is something that, you know, it's a common theme I think now in a lot of these Marvel shows in different contexts, the idea that a lot of these superheroes, and obviously in Loki he's much more of an anti-hero, is these people going up against authority, you know, in this case the time variant's authority. It feels like that name is quite, you know, pointed in this context. You know, in the Falcon and the Winter Soldier, you've got these The big question in that show was, were the Flag Smashers the bad guys, or was it actually like the government order in charge? And to be honest, it was a bit of both by the end. And then in WandaVision, you've got the fact that S.W.O.R.D., you know, the guy running S.W.O.R.D., he's particularly dodgy, and they're manipulating technology and all this kind of stuff. So you've got all these people who are in these positions of power, and they are in many ways abusing it, or they're hiding things. And that obviously is the big revelation with the TVA. We found out in Lamentis last week that they're all variants, which was a bit of a whoa kind of revelation that changes the game, just dropped in there. And this week we get a lot more context for that, which we'll talk about. But I think it's a good way of positioning Sylvie. And you know what? I this did more for the character for me. I found Lamentis the least enjoyable episode yet, and I think the reason was that I found her just a little bit grating at points for me. I felt like she was too... They were going too heavily into her being this quite difficult... So this difficult version of Jodie Whittaker's Doctor, because they look quite similar.
Yeah,
they've got a slightly similar cadence to their voice. But I just found it all a little bit grating last week. And it did. And I understand the grounding of that relationship and the reason Lamentis as an episode existed completely. I get it. But I found it was a lot. It wasn't much to warrant an entire episode for me personally, but I think it was necessary in order to get to a point where you get that lovely scene of Sylvie and Loki as Lamentis is about to explode or be destroyed, and she tells the backstory, you know, that we see at the beginning as she escapes from Renslayer and jumps through time. And I think that made retro. I mean, loads of people loved Lamentis, so I'm probably a man alone here, but that made, for me, Sylvie a stronger character in this episode, because it grounds her a little bit and you understand where that darkness comes from, I think.
I think for me, Lamentis, I enjoyed. I didn't enjoy the action scene towards the end. I just didn't like the way it was directed at all. So that threw me off. But I actually did enjoy some of the quieter scenes. I'm very much an exposition or, you know, just sit down and talk person anyway, so quite like that anyway. But I think you're right. I think the... To have Sylvie in that kind of grated way in last episode, to have this flipped on its head, that you've obviously Sylvie's been brought in as, you know, the person who you're going to like sort of eventually go against to begin with, but then you flip that and she becomes, you know, one of the protagonists in the show. It's like kind of it makes a big flip really quickly. But I don't think you could do that really. You'd need more time. And I think that, you know, they've done it in quite an effective way that you can understand the reason why she is the way she is. So I think they've done that really quickly and effectively.
Yeah, me too. And I think alongside that, I think they've nicely allowed us to buy into the idea that maybe she and Loki are falling for each other, or particularly Loki is falling for her. She seems by the end a little bit like, well, what are you trying to tell me? And you get the feeling it seems like Loki's going to tell her he loves her or something along those lines. And that this whole episode is builds to that, which we will get to. But I admit, much as what I've just said about Lamentis, I don't think without that episode you could have had the moments between those characters in this episode that did work well. And you're right, and you would buy the affection they do have for each other and that interplay. And I think that's a strength that and Loki, I think, has constructed that quite quickly, pretty well, really, given that it's on a limited runtime. And I appreciate that, because I think it allows Loki as a character to be different in this and for them to get away with it. I was thinking about this when I was watching it, and I was thinking about how Loki is being a lot more introspective, you know, and he's starting to accept some of his flaws. And then I thought, well, actually, this is the Loki. This isn't the Loki who went through Ragnarok. This isn't the Loki that went through Infinity War, you know, and all these things, you know, which obviously we saw in the first episode. You know, he hasn't had that growth. This is the Loki at the end of Avengers who was a complete tit. Still at that point. So to actually do that in just a couple of episodes and actually make him more like the Loki, I guess, who we did see at the start of Infinity War, who was killed by Thanos. I think that's a testament to how how well they've constructed this season.
Yeah, and I think you've got to bear in mind as well that he's still in a little bit of shock with everything that he's seen in episode one as well. There's which, you know, seeing it on screen and getting the shock from it rather than living it, you can't imagine what that's like. You know, living it is bad enough, but then just thinking everything's okay and then seeing all this massive trauma that's going to happen, you know, and, you know, you've got a chance to potentially replay that or do something different, you know, and to like sort of really like look at you introspectively, as you say. It's, you know, it's an interesting way to play it because it's, you know, you can play around with the characteristics of him in that way. And I thought that's a really interesting way that they've done it. And especially, as you say, with the fact it's the 2012 Loki as well, that you can have that shock, you know, with him. Whereas like, if it was like an Avengers Endgame Loki after the fact, you know, that's already been played out. So I think it's interesting that they've done it that way.
Yeah, and giving him a love interest, which, again, I think only works because you like Hiddleston as the character. You know, and you like what they've done with the character. Be able to give him that romance, essentially, or that sparky kind of interplay with a female character. Although, you know, it could have been a male character. You know, he is gender fluid. You know, so they could have just had another male Loki. And to be fair, I think it would have worked just as well. I don't think it has to, you know, hinge on Sylvie being a woman. You know, it just happens to be that way because I think it's based on a character, more of a character from the comics. So, you know, that's also a credit to the show that it hasn't shied away from those aspects without making it the whole point of the show. I think it's nicely sort of integrated that kind of thing, even if this episode isn't fully about identity as such necessarily.
Yeah. What do you think then of this kind of love trope thing of that the timeline starts to split off when they start having those feelings for each other? You know, it's very kind of like loads of sci-fi shows have done it before. Matrix did it, you know, where Neo comes back to life because she loves him. You know, and there's an element of that. I personally don't think it's too on the nose. But what did you make to it? Because it's interesting itself.
Yeah, I think it's cheesy as hell, but I think the show absolutely gets away with it. and it's to be fair, that is such a Doctor Who kind of plot twist. You know, in that show completely makes all of the science, well, it's not science, it's magic in that show, and a lot of that magic is based on human connection, or it's based on the power of the mind, the human mind or the human heart. You know, you'll get like the Doctor and the entire universe brought back because Amy Pond remembers who he is. Like, that's literally it, like, you know.
Yeah.
And in no other show could that actually work, you know, in that it has to be that kind of show that has the sort of cosmic whimsy and it's built into the DNA. And I think Loki does have that. So I think I absolutely was fine with that. I thought, because I did think, how the hell are they going to get them out of here? Like they've got like an entire planet raining down on them. How is this going to happen? So I actually thought it was quite a neat way of doing that.
Yeah. I mean, the way I pass it for me, I don't know if this is the truth or the way that obviously it's fresh in my mind, is that it's almost like predestination for me that because they've started to love each other, the fact that Loki is dealing with his narcissistic side, that he is dealing with things like, is he going to be alone for the rest of his life, you know, or lives or multiple variants of lives? Is that the fact that he's kind of confiding in someone and actually working together with someone and actually loving someone? Is that a predestination that the fact that they were saved? Because if they weren't saved, nothing would have changed. So for me, it feels like that's the beginning of what we haven't seen yet. In my eyes, it's like, so it's not so much about the way I pass it. It was not so much about them and love like conquers all and the universe wants to break free. So the universe made them love each other and now it manifests into chaos. I think there is an element of that. I think that it is like because of their love together, and they were stronger together, that actually ends up being the beginning of like the, you know, the C-20s and the B-15s of this world and the Mobiuses of this world actually understanding their part, and they are individuals. And that's like almost like a flowering effect, and it kind of permeates through the TVA and things. So I think that is a way I would potentially pass it, which I think is different than, say, like a Matrix, where it's just like you know, because I was destined, I love you. And it's like, hey, wakes up. All right, great, no problem. I think that the branch is actually that. I think it's, you know, it's the beginning of something, not necessarily just right at that moment.
Well, you could be right, actually, because my guess is that Loki as an entire concept is the beginning of the broader multiverse idea anyway. I think it is the seed of a much, much bigger, you know, ongoing thing within Marvel. So this, on that small context, could well be, you know, that spark of life, the gods coming together to spark into life, you know, the understanding of the people within the TVA. It could well be. And I think it is an important event in the context of this show. You know, while yes, a lot of shows wouldn't necessarily get away with the hamminess of it, I think this does. And I think it allows the characters to nicely, you know, neatly return to the TVA and be placed in those scenarios. You know, and it adds to Loki's, you know, growth as a character. I mean, that I thought the whole time loop, you know, prison was so clever as a means of having him be able to come to terms, well, to face the perception of him as being somebody who was going to be alone forever. You know, and that's what Sif tells him, you're going to be alone forever. Yeah. Because of your actions, and he has to in that you know nightmare groundhog minute scenario, he has to like replay. I thought that was a very neat and clever way of shortcutting to his own revelations, internal revelations, that are in line with maybe the idea that he can let somebody in, you know, and that the whole arc of Loki that we saw in the earlier Thor films and everything, that the rejected brother who's never going to be Thor, who's never going to be thought of in the same way, who desperately wants power just because really he just wants to be noticed. And that's essentially what he admits in this episode. I think it's great. And Sylvie is potentially the only person he's got that true connection with that's different. And I think that's where it stands out and it works.
Yeah. Well, there's a few things that you've said there that I want to bring up. So, WandaVision, as expected.
32 minutes, 34
as expected. Well, I'm thinking because this occurs, obviously TVA, it's all relative time, this occurs before WandaVision. And I'm just thinking, you know, we've got Doctor Strange 2 coming up. You've got Wanda looking for Billy and Tommy, you know, at the end of that credit scene, which I will mention right now. Have you seen the people going around on the internet about that scene recently? Have you seen the news on that? So they've edited.
Is this a spoiler or is it theory?
No, it's a theory. It's a theory.
Okay, well, all right, run safe,
Brian. Yeah, we are. Safe. They've edited the final scene in WandaVision, the very final scene, the post-credit scene. Now, there's two things. There's Michael Giacchino's music for Doctor Strange 2 has been added to the credits, but they think that's just the fact that the theme music was in there, but they didn't want to give that away too much, so they left it and re-edited it. And then there's extra trees that have been put into the scene where they're flying through to see Wanda in a house. And there's something that happens in the top left-hand corner of the screen, and it looks like it's like a figure that's coming down. So people are saying, ooh, could be Doctor Strange. Now, what they're saying, what they're actually saying is it was a lighting error, and they will fix that lighting error when they were there. So they fix a mistake, but the mistake is still there. That's what they're saying. That's what they're saying.
I thought you were going to say it was Mephisto. Because everyone's waiting for Mephisto to turn up.
You know, it could be flies or anything. But talking about episodes, so in episode 7 of WandaVision, they have the Nexus commercial. So people are kind of like saying, well, right, okay, so I think that there's a multitude of different things that are going to happen or have happened that causes the sacred timeline to basically create what it is. So there was that indication in this episode, you know, and everything else that, you know, potentially it could be numerous different things that could happen. And this is what causes the, what happened in Doctor Strange 2. Also, as well, it was great to see Jamie Alexander back. You know, I mean, I've loved her from Blindspot, and it did remind me I need to finish Blindspot because that's a show that's finished now. And I haven't watched the episodes. Yeah, so that was good. It is very kind of interesting. The tattoos all tell, like, crimes that are 3 years old and all kinds of things. It's very weird.
I've heard of it. And, yeah.
And the time loop of what he's going through is very much like Lucifer's hell in Tom Ellis's Lucifer. So in hell, you replay your worst moment or like a moment of your life, which, you know, which is like your internal hell. And it's how you feel guilty about yourself. So that to me felt very Lucifer, that scene with Jamie Alexander and Sif. So, so those are the things that came up on there. But it was a nice cameo for her, and I thought it must have been quite a good scene to film.
It must have been a bit fun, yeah. I was trying to think with the last time we saw Sif. I mean, because she was she in Ragnarok? I don't think she was in Ragnarok.
She wasn't in Ragnarok.
She?
No.
She wasn't one of the. They all got slaughtered, didn't they, in Ragnarok, all of his old team, but she wasn't there. So I feel like it's either the Dark World or it's that episode of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. that she crops up in
right.
like season two, which is going back a few years now. And, you know, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. is maybe not canon anymore. Although, once they have this multiverse thing kick
anything's
off,
possible.
People can just say, oh, well, it's just its own thing. So it's been a good, I'd say, five years or more since we've seen Sif. So,
yeah
it's a nice little fun cameo. Because she is, you know, she's a very sort of workhorse sort of Asgard sort of character, but she's good. Mm. You know, she's good value.
So hopefully
they will... I don't know if she's back in Love and Thunder. Probably not, given that cast is like 1,000 people in that one. But but it was nice to see her in this, definitely. That the whole idea that Mobius puts him in that time loop prison is fun. I mean, I part of the reason that I didn't love Lamentis as much is because we didn't have any Mobius, because I do think Owen Wilson is the secret source of this show, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
He is so good as this character. He brings that real... And it's, you know, it's mentioned, Loki takes the mickey out of him with this, his folksy sort of way of doing things, but he brings that brilliant Owen Wilson folksy charm to this character, and he grounds it in such a level of enjoyable comedic calm that I just think those two together are absolutely great. That's one of the reasons I really like the variant as an episode, because you get lots of those two together in scenes. So I think he's a really, really good... I think he's been a really good character for this show.
Yeah. I think he's a linchpin, isn't he? Because he talks so much with Renslayer. He's got different characteristics. With Renslayer, he's kind of, you know, he's starting to question himself as well. You've got... And Renslayer saying, I'm doing this to protect you. He's got his own theory with that. That's somebody he's worked with for so long. You've got this new character, this new Loki for him that he's, you know, he's mentioned, I think B-15 says, your pet kind of thing. And so he's got a number of different things happening, and he's the one that's holding everything together. The story's been kind of revolving around him, and it's... It is interesting what happens to him in this episode, but it's, overall, I think he's been an absolute brilliant addition, and I just love how he gets under the skin. He psychologically analyzes what he needs to do to get Loki to say the things that he needs to say, and that in itself, I think, for Mobius being that psychologist in that way, is interesting, because we've never seen Loki in this position. Loki is finding himself in quite dangerous situations because he's starting to let people in, and when he starts to let people in, like in this one where he's talking about the love for Sylvie, and then when Mobius does what we think may well be death or not, depending on what we'll say, but we'll talk about that later, he has an emotional response, and that's something we're not used to seeing, and he's starting to open up to people, and Mobius is a kind of linchpin for that as well.
He's an important character in that he brings something out of Loki, I think, which is good. You know, he has that dynamic with him which is unexpected in some ways. You know, it is that grounding element, and I think you've seen enough of Mobius to know that he's quite a virtuous character in this context, and it is a little bit of the show. Actually, this episode reminds me a little bit of Alias, which is a show that I love, and I will talk about it till the cows come home. And because that whole show is built around an agency who are filled with people who think they're right, they're working for the good guys, and in fact they're working for the bad guys. And that's exactly what is happening with Mobius and everybody else. We've come to B-15 as well. played by the great Wumi Masaku, who's just excellent. She was so good in Lovecraft Country, but she's really good in this as well. And that revelation that they're actually not working for the good guys, you know, ultimately, and that there's that there is somebody who knows the truth and he's concealing it from them. It's similar, actually, in many ways. It kind of just occurred to me as I'm speaking about this. And Mobius is going through that moment of revelation and realization in this episode as the scales fall from his eyes and he realizes that actually, you know, his life, his entire existence is not what he thought it was. I did think, actually, and I don't think it is at all, but I did think, you know, at the very beginning when Sylvie's brought in as a child, she sees a guy brought in, a variant with big, long, straggly hair.
Yeah.
And I did think, is that Mobius for a minute? I did wonder, like...
right, okay.
I don't think it is. I haven't gone back and checked.
But, that's one to look back on.
Yeah, that's one to check. It probably isn't. But I think it is a really good development for that character, I think, in that you get to see the revelation of the TVA almost through his eyes.
Yeah, and it adds that kind of, you know, kind of the underbelly of like working for the company and stuff. And again, it's that overall thing of control, you know, which I find really, really interesting in this whole thing, because I know that the, you know, we'll talk about the actual, you know, the timekeepers themselves, but just this element of control over the workforce and just the slave labor that they're kind of doing, and they don't even know it, and that's the harrowing thought. It's like, you know, there's the slavery where people know what they're, you know, that they're slaves, but they don't even know it. They've had lives, and the fact that people are being revealed to them to have that, and it's according to the sacred timeline, it's inconsequential to their aim. And it's almost like, and talking about demigods and stuff, it's like the actual timeline itself doesn't all the variants doesn't matter to them. All it's concerned about is this sacred timeline. So the fact that lives are inconsequential is really dark, you know. It's almost touching on genocide and stuff, really. So it's quite a harrowing, dark sort of theme.
And you're right when you say slavery. That word actually was going through my head as well. But in the last, you know, since the revelation about the variants, and particularly in this episode, they are essentially slaves. You know, they're slaves who've been conditioned to believe they've been created for a purpose, for a higher purpose, to protect something that is considered with religious reverence, the sacred timeline. You know, it is sacred. It is to be protected. It is to be guarded. And we don't really know why either. You know, we don't really know why. And it's this whole idea of these, and as you say, we'll get to the timekeepers, but it's this whole idea of these silent gods in the background who are dictating everything, who you must revere, you know, at all, even though you never see them, even though they're always behind the curtain, you know. It's an interesting concept in itself, the very fact they've gone for a sacred timeline, something to be protected. And I think there's a lot of interesting connotations, like you say, about control, about the idea of, you know, because well, you might as well talk about the timekeepers now, to be fair, because we're sort of on this subject. So, I mean, that they are revealed to be puppets, essentially. They're revealed to be androids.
Inaudible androids, in my eyes.
honestly, my wife said this. Yeah.
I'm going to have to rewind that. I literally, during the first showing of it, I went, I have not understood a single word that one's just said. So I had to put the subtitles on. It was that bad.
Do you think that's intentional, though? Or do you think it's just a mistake?
I don't know. I just thought it was my 41-year-old ears, like, sort of giving up on me. But
no, it's not just you. My wife had the same problem. And there was one in particular that I was a bit like, well, very garbled. What he's saying is very garbled. I think it was designed intentionally in order to present them as being the very sort of cosmic, weird sort of, you know, what beings that you might get in the Marvel comics.
Yeah.
You know, well, things that...
Let's get it right. It was Star Wars 1, The Phantom Menace, wasn't it?
It was a bit.
That's what it was.
Droid Deckers. Yeah, it was proper like... They were it's basically the Trade Federation is essentially, yeah. Oh, my God. Every time I think of those guys, I can't quite believe they exist. There is something to that. They're very puppet-like, you know, and very sort of, You know, intentionally CGI, intentionally ridiculous almost, intentionally the kind of things that you would get in the comics that wouldn't play on screen, which is one of the reasons why they've, you know, with the MCU, they have adapted things to seem less arch and ridiculous, you know, because if you go back to the, and this does have relevance to when we talk about the post-credit scene later, but when you go, if you go back to the early 60s kind of stuff in the Marvel comics, it's ridiculous now. It's absolutely barmy, and they would never be able to do those kind of storylines in this day and age. So I think the Timekeepers are an intentional, in this context, are an intentional way of presenting false gods, ultimately.
I apologise, but it's like when Elizabeth Olsen was told, no, you'll never have to wear that costume.
Oh, why am I not surprised you have brought up Elizabeth Olsen in costumes? Somehow. But yeah, I think the false gods aspect of the Timekeepers, it didn't surprise me. I don't know about you. I wrote a piece on Loki after the variant, and I did say in that I didn't think they actually existed ultimately, and I thought the whole point of this was going to be that there is no one behind the curtain. It was going to be a Jacob from Lost situation, you know, in the cabin, Jacob's cabin in Lost. If you haven't guessed, guys, Luke, Kurt and I are big Lost fans, so you know, this is why we keep bringing it up. But I did think it was going to be a smoke and mirrors kind of situation. And I was half right in my thought process there, I suppose, wasn't I, really? I guess they do and they don't exist, really.
I think if it was nobody behind the curtain, you wouldn't be asking the question, who's controlling the puppets? So,
well, yeah.
So I think there's a bit, an element to that, right, okay, and Loki even says it, doesn't he? He said, well, if they're not them, who's the one that's controlling them?
Who are they?
So, yes.
Everyone's wondering if it might be Kang the Conqueror.
I've heard that. I don't know anything about that. I was thinking Mephisto myself, but that's just...
Well, it's obviously going to be Mephisto, isn't it? You know, at the end of the day. But Kang the Conqueror has been cast in Ant-Man and the Wasp 2.
I did hear that Renslayer was Kang's girlfriend in one of the comics or something. Potentially,
in the comics.
So, yeah.
Kang the Conqueror is a time-travelling... I think Mark might have mentioned this in the previous episode, but he's like a time-travelling supervillain from ancient Egypt, in part from ancient Egypt.
Right.
He's going to be played by Jonathan Majors in the movie. It wouldn't surprise me. It wouldn't actually surprise me if there was a link. But it's hard to say. I think ultimately... What did you think of this as a revelation, though? What did you think of this as the sort of presentation of the Timekeepers? You know, they're in this... top floor, I guess, if you think of the TVA as like a big, you know, building of offices or whatever, and they're presented in these very sort of arch, sort of strange terms, aren't they?
They are, but I also think that you can imagine in a movie, like, say, for example, they were real, that you'd be brought into them in this grandiose thing. There's only that light behind them and a room, and I think that the way they've downplayed it works, so it's not like the most grandiose entrance for them. And as you say, the fact that they are looking like the puppets and they are looking like, oh, there's something not quite right with them. And even when they've said, like, say, protect the Timekeepers, I'm like going, I'm not sure about this. Because it just felt false. But I actually think it felt that way on purpose, like you've said, with the way they kind of look like puppets or look like CGI puppets. So I did think that. The way, because obviously Renslayer is the only one that's been going in there. So the fact that it is behind that curtain of Renslayer is the voice of, and it was interesting that when she did take Sylvie, that there was another guy in that point. So she's obviously been promoted to that thing, which asks another number of questions about who was that. And if Renslayer is part of the Kang thing, you know, and whether or not we get an overt thing, I don't think the way the TV shows are going, I don't think we're going to get overt particular things that will link in. I think the movies are being reserved for that. So I think there will be a link. I think the Renslayer might be that link to Kang, but we might not necessarily get that until we get into, say, something like Doctor Strange 2 or Ant-Man or wherever it may well be that they're going to introduce them to. And then we'll get that link a little bit more in that way. But I think that Renslayer herself, if we want to talk about her for a second, her comments, one... I thought the way she sort of, the way that Sylvie upplays the fact of, like, what was it in my life that must have been important? And she just says, I don't remember. That is so cutting. which I thought was brilliant. I thought that was really grounded, evil way of like of bringing someone in, because anyone can say that. The power of words, you know, if you've been with an old partner or whoever it may well be, you can hurt somebody by saying one or two words, three words.
Yeah.
And the fact that that's something that Renssei did there by saying, I don't remember. You know,
and she does remember.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing. She's saying that on purpose, isn't she? You know,
yeah.
To be cruel, essentially.
Yeah. And then towards the end, when we actually do get the scene where Sylvie's like looking on top of her with the actual staff, there's just a moment there where I'm thinking, she wants it to end as well. So there's an ambivalence there between what is going on with her. So I do like that they've added that little minutia detail there.
Well, I think you know, firstly, credit to the casting of Gugu Mbatha-Raw, because she's great. She's a great actor, and we're not used to seeing her play one of these morally compromised characters either. Usually she's rocking up in stuff like, you know, Belle or Misbehavior, or, you know, years ago she was in Undercovers, the short-lived J.J. Abrams show, or she was in Doctor Who. She was Martha Jones's sister way back in Doctor Who. And she is a great actor, and I think she's taken a role that was at first potentially quite slim and has built that out. And she has this very interesting relationship with Mobius, which is built on a strange dynamic of friendship, a weird hint of not necessarily sexual attraction, but a love there between them, which is odd. A little bit. And, you know, she sort of gets to, they sort of talk about that. They have some really good, interesting conversations over these few episodes. And in this one, they have a one or two. And in their conversation, they talk, I think it's Renslayer who says that, you know, our friendship is rare, essentially. It is a rarity. You know, we've seen all of time, and what we have is quite special. And there is a mystery about her, you're right, in that we don't quite know where she's coming from. She seems to be in league with whoever's behind the timekeepers, but I'm more inclined to believe that she's acting under duress to some extent. Like in the scene where, you know, Mobius is looking at the pad he stole, and he sees Renslayer with the agent who dies.
Yeah, C20.
And C20 is revealing what Sylvie told Loki. And you see Renslayer poke her head in. She doesn't necessarily look like saying stop the tape. She doesn't necessarily look like the arch villain. I just think there is, and like you say, the last moment sort of suggests that she just, please let this be over. So she knows who's behind all this. She knows the theatre and the pantomime potentially behind the timekeepers. But what is happening to her? You know, has she been? She obviously knows that she's a variant.
Yeah. Or
when did that happen? Has she always known? Has she always been there to help whoever is pulling the strings pull the strings? And why all the theatre? Why the timekeepers? Why create these androids? There's lots and lots of fascinating questions that I think we're gonna hopefully see over these next two episodes.
Yeah, it's certainly going to be interesting. I think that's a good question about the time. You know, the timekeepers is like, were they there? How were they overthrown? Were they even there in the first place? There's a lot to answer and a lot of really interesting questions. And it's good that a show can ask those questions and leave you hanging. So,
and it could still go anywhere. I mean, that's one of the things about, and I think they said this in one of the earlier episodes of this, talking about Loki, in that as great as WandaVision was, for the most part, we did have an idea where that might go to some extent. And we weren't necessarily completely shocked when it got to roughly there. You know, I think a lot of people had guessed that, you know, Catherine Hahn was going to be Agatha Harkness and she was going to be the bad guy and all this kind of thing. And then and then Falcon and the Winter Soldier, again, I won't spoil too much for you, Kurt, because you haven't seen all of it, but but you can kind of guess roughly where it's probably going to go, and where it goes, it ends up, it could have gone several different ways. But again, well, with this, I have no idea. I have no idea what the end of episode 6 is going to look like. I mean, even now, I mean, this episode's completely sort of done what I thought they might do in the finale.
Yeah.
You know, potentially get them to the timekeepers, expose the timekeepers as not really being there. But they've done it in episode 4, so what the hell is going to happen next? You know, that's the great thing. Yeah. That's what I really like about this.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. It's going on, definitely on a roller coaster, almost on a Mobius strip, should we say.
Speaking of Mobius, is he alive?
It depends. We can maybe discuss that. I don't know. It depends what you consider the after credits scene to be.
We'll get to that. I suppose, before we talk about the post-credit scene, is there anything else we've missed, Kurt? Have we missed anything talking about this, or do you think we've covered most of the main beats here?
Just a couple of notes that I put down is I like the fact that Morbius had that worky-loki. I thought that's a nice little mantra that he's been given. Vampires were mentioned, so obviously Blade is certainly an interesting one. That is something I'm aware of.
Yeah.
I found the conversation between Sylvie and Loki when they were saying about destined to lose really interesting. The fact that it says we may lose sometimes painfully, but we don't die, we survive. You know, so I think that that's interesting that Loki's over time, they're that mischievous that they're just, this is a pain in the ass. Put it that way. And they always seem, they just never die. They always find a way. They always find a cheat. So I thought that was really interesting. Just with B-15, I think it alludes to something I've already mentioned, but the fact that B-15 has her kind of reverse, I don't think you've seen Blade Runner, have you? Or you're not fond of it?
The reverse, I just don't like it. I have seen it.
It's kind of like the reverse conversation in the rain. Yeah, moment where she's like, felt a little bit like that. But I do like the idea of, like, that is the thought. So that's the moment where Sylvie's kind of like almost building her army to say, you're like me. So I did like that, and B-15 is the start of that, and obviously she comes to save them towards the end.
I did think that was a really nice scene, actually. I thought that was a great moment in a way that you really see B-15's trauma about this. And she previously has been a very stalwart sort of enforcer character within the TVA. And then so to see her actually have that moment of, well, these memories, I was happy, you know, and it was really sad. It was a sad moment, actually, that was very well done in that instant, that you really feel that these people are being exploited, enslaved. And now, essentially, Loki and Sylvie are going to become freedom fighters, to free these people from the whatever the TVA is, whatever this creation is, to protect a particular string of time, a particular course that time is on. I think that's great. I think the way they did that was really, really, really good.
And I'm one, you know me, I love my melancholy. So the fact that you have that darkness there.
I don't know what you mean. Like, you've never suggested through podcasting any sort of, you know, enjoyability of melancholy. You know, it's not like you've talked about the TV series Millennium for three seasons. I don't know where you're getting that from, Kurt.
Exactly. But again, I might mention I'm on a Millennium podcast, but there we go. So I just found that really, really, really nice. And the fact that, as you say, the reverse of it is like, the life that she's physically living, that reveals so much about what she's actually doing as what she feels like she's trapped in. And Morbius is trapped in as well. It's all this, we allowed to do this. I want my jet skis and he can't. Now, whether or not there's allusion to the fact that he did have jet skis in the first place is now interesting. But the fact that she's living this, like, as I say, this kind of strict life of, you know, I must oppress, I must do this, I must do this. And the fact that she's actually got happy memories hidden away somewhere is really interesting. And I thought that having Sylvie having this enchantress kind of like power of memories is interesting, and purely because of Wanda as well, because Wanda's has similar powers that she can do that as well. Whether or not it's slightly different.
You just have to bring different. It back. You just no, have I'm to just bring
saying,
it back to Wanda.
I'm saying it's one's red and one's green, right. So what the colours have been, I don't know. But
there's loads and loads of possibilities for this, and I think it's going to be really exciting to see how it all unfurls out in these final two episodes. And we're not going to be back for those. You're going to be back with some of your regular hosts, Carpenter and Mark. We'll be back to talk the last couple of episodes of Loki with some guests. But it's been a real pleasure to do this with you, Kurt, today.
It has been, thank you. It's been a long time since we've podcasted together for a while, so it's been good to do that. And it's also nice to be back on this podcast as well, because obviously there's been quite a long hiatus. I was meant to be doing one a while back, and I didn't actually end up doing it. So it's nice to be able to both speak to you again and to jump back onto the Marvel Universe. So I'm reinvigorated with Marvel now as well, so that's always good.
That's cool. We're both going to be back to talk some What If, I think, as well. at some point, which is supposedly coming in August, we think. They haven't fully confirmed any of that yet, but we're both going to pop up for some of those because that's going to be a lot of fun and a bit different again.
Yeah.
So it won't be the last time you hear Kurt or myself on Podcast 616. Keep playing for the post-credit scene where we're talking about the post-credit scene. So we're not quite going anywhere yet. But until we do return on Podcast 616, Kurt, where else can everybody find you on We Made This and the general internet?
Yeah, so we've talked about sci-fi, Doctor Who and stuff like that, but you can generally find me on the X-Cast. So we're covering Season 7. The X-Cast was formed by somebody called Tony Black. I don't know if you've heard of him. I don't know. No idea.
Some variant of Tony.
Oh, God, can you imagine variants of Tony? Man.
nobody wants that in the world. No way.
Unless Carl, Sarah and I are variants of you and now running the X-Cast. That might be it.
Anything's possible. It's the multiverse.
So you can find me on the X-Files podcast. Currently, just about planning and recording Season 7, so that's coming out very soon. And you can find that on the X_cast. I mentioned the Millennium one. We're just about at the closing stages for the Millennium one, which is the spin-off to the X-Files. And that you can find that at the Time Is Now pod. And then finally, Star Trek Picard and the Red Dwarf podcast. So Star Trek Picard is at Jean-Luc Podard, where Luke and Mike Slamer, I think was on recently, talking about the new trailer. And we'll be there for any news that comes on for Star Trek Picard. And then finally, Shipwrecked and Comatose, which is the Red Dwarf podcast, which Mark Adams and I co-host for that, which obviously people will know Mark from this show. And you can find that at Red Dwarf Pod.
Magic stuff. Kurt is one of the stalwarts of We Made This, which is the podcast network that I oversee and created at WMT_network, WeMadeThisNetwork.com. So you can find all the podcasts I'm on. I spread myself around various different things these days, and I'm overseeing things generally.
You're the man behind the curtain, aren't you?
I'm the timekeeper, keeping the sacred podcast timeline going, yeah. But yeah, you can also find me on Twitter at AJBlackWriter. As well, where you'll see all my links to my website and all the other writing I'm doing and various different bits and bobs. So yeah, we're both active. You'll hear us and see us around, no doubt. And thanks for joining us generally for another episode of Podcast 616. Remember, we're part of the We Made This podcast network I've just mentioned, and Loki is not all we're discussing, so we'll give you a taste of what you might have missed on the network in a minute. Stay tuned for that post-credit scene discussion, and we'll see you next time on the show on Podcast 616, where we are burdened with glorious purpose to talk about the MCU.
Elsewhere on We Made This.
The Movie Palace.
Yeah, I can remember my first viewing of The Sound of Music quite distinctly, actually, because it was 8 days ago.
You've never seen it before that?
8 days ago was the first time I'd sat down to watch it from start to finish. Now, I always associate The Sound of Music. It's interesting that you both talk about it as an Easter thing. It is associated with bank holidays here, but I don't think it's just Easter. So I had seen a lot of these sequences. I think if I was inside on a bank holiday when I was a child and The Sound of Music was on, it was normally a bad thing because it meant it was raining and I couldn't go out and play football.
Shipwrecked and Comatose, a Red Dwarf podcast.
I've got 5 tattoos. So I started getting tattoos when I was about 5 years ago, and it was just sort of one by one, I guess. So not huge coverage, but I'm definitely got the bug, so to speak. So, but the latest one is the Red Dwarf one. Yeah,
and that's the one you've decided to talk about today. Describe it for me.
Yeah.
Free with this month's issue.
Obviously, you must remember the sign in musical exchanges.
I do indeed.
Do not play. Yeah. But there was a few riffs, weren't there, that you weren't allowed to play? This being top of them.
Enter Sandman, Smoke on the Water, Stairway to Heaven, anything widdly above the 12th fret, I think that song said.
Yeah. There's a lot of people that paid no attention to that shit. Remember when we almost got thrown out for playing with that delay pedal?
Yes.
Amazing.
I also remember the day that I went in with my birthday money to musical exchanges to buy a pedal, and I ended up buying the Boss Hyper Metal, and I was insisting to the bloke that I was buying it from. I was like, I don't really play much metal, I just like the sound of it. I want to use it for sort of, you know, more experimental sounds. Like, you're wearing a Metallica t-shirt.
I'm not that into metal, actually.
I want to do something more like Swans with it, like My Bloody Valentine, that kind of thing.
Which I did, but I was wearing a Metallica t-shirt at the time.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. Okay, so we've got a bit to chew on here, haven't we, really? Because you, when I asked you about Mobius earlier, obviously Mobius gets pruned, as Renslayer says. But when she does the same to Loki, and he gets pruned, disappears, killed, quote-unquote, he then wakes up. So can we assume that Mobius isn't dead? And even maybe that Mobius might be here as well, in the same place as Loki?
So the question I would ask is that they're all variants of Loki that he's actually ended up with. So is it a Loki thing, or is it a pruning thing? Would be the two questions. Because if it's a pruning thing, then yes, potentially. Is it more of a Loki thing that they've just been taken out of time and it's some sort of magical thing? Then that's the question. I personally don't think they're going to get rid of Owen Wilson without him coming back in two episodes.
No.
From what we said before, he's so much of an integral part to the show. I can't see it happening. But
same.
It is interesting. One thing I did look at that, we're talking about how inaudibility of the timekeepers. So I put the subtitles on, and I'm glad I did, because when he says, "Am I in hell?" Hell is spelt with one L, because obviously it's the Norwegian or the Norsk hell,
right,
which is like, so obviously there's the creature of hell, and there's also the, you know, the fact that he believes he's in that place of hell.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a nice touch, that actually, that they've, in this, even in the subtitles, they're actually referring to Loki's hell, not the hell
that we
would know. So I thought that was quite cool.
Yeah, I like that. That's really good. That is really good. It seems like he is in New York, as it turns out, because he's in what looks like a dystopia, a post-apocalypse. I think somebody mentioned, I think I saw on like social media, that maybe you can see possibly a destroyed Avengers Tower in the background.
Right.
A Tony Stark's tower. Which might, maybe, does this suggest that he is in New York?
2012
Loki,
again.
Yeah. It's a New York that where maybe he won, and maybe all the Avengers were wiped out and the Chitauri aliens destroyed New York or and more. And somehow all of these variant Lokis have been deposited there in some sort of timeline wasteland that doesn't exist. Could it be that?
So kind of like a Doctor Who fixed point in time kind of thing. But that would be in itself interesting.
A Loki junkyard. where they get rid of all the variant Lokis who cause trouble.
Yeah, and I'd say if it is Multitude of Madness or the timey-wimey kind of the very various different branches all conversing on that one pivotal moment, and all the Lokis do end up going back to that pivotal moment because that's where the first factor is or something like that, maybe. That is very Doctor Who if they did go down that route.
Very, very. It's interesting, though. I mean, it's worth pointing out that this is the first post-credit sequence that Loki's done as a show. And like I think most of us, I have been checking every week after the credits. I always go forward, and then with the Disney in the UK anyway, you just have like by the very end, it's got all the different languages that it's in, and I still go to that point and I check.
And I've got to make sure I do that on my phone though, because waiting on the TV version of Disney Plus that I've got, you start fast forwarding, and you pass the credit scene. I'm like, oh, God.
You've passed the credits.
Right. I'm going to have to do it on my phone and just check on my phone to see if anything comes up. Then I'm like, right, I'll watch it on the TV now.
I bet everyone does this. I would not be surprised. Because I think Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. sort of made us think that maybe this was going to be a common thing, as well as the movies, was going to maybe make us think that this would be a common factor of these shows, but it's not. They're actually choosing when to drop a post-credit, which I think actually is quite good, because it means they actually have a bit more impact. Like, this was a little bit of a proper sort of post-credits thing, which is good. It's in the spirit of Marvel. When some of the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. ones in the end were a little bit like, okay, you know, it became so normal that the excitement of it didn't quite last. Whereas here, it really does impact, I think, when you get something.
Yeah, I think it does impact. And I think one of the reasons for that, and the thought did enter my mind, when Loki was killed, I was looking at it going, really? Really? You really going to do that? Is that going to happen? But then in my mind, I know people will think this anyway, because everyone will react differently to it. Some people will think that's the end of him. Oh my God, they're doing that. They've actually killed him. Could they get another version or whatever? And it could be, is Sylvie going to take over the last two episodes? You know, there's an element of that as well. Yeah, so that leaves you for that time to mull over what are the ramifications for that. You know, people I've seen online, you know, on the YouTube ones of people being upset, obviously, the fact that he's gone. And, you know, then all of a sudden, the next thing you see is a flash and he's on screen. It's like, oh right, okay. You know, and it as you say, it works for that effect. And it just gives you that moment because... In some ways, in my head, I was like going, they weren't brave enough to do it. It would have been really interesting if they were brave enough just to go, right, he's not in the last two episodes, but it's just not, that's not going to be possible.
No way.
But, you know, but it would have been really interesting to see what Sylvie would become after that. So
that would have been a twist and a half.
Yeah. And the amount of letters they would have got for that, Jesus.
Oh, my God. Yeah, can you imagine?
But it's so yeah, I think the fact that it's all Lokis, going back to the Immobus question, I think that they're all Lokis. And as you say, it's the fact that it did look like New York. I didn't factor in the first time I saw it. I've watched it two and a bit times. And I had heard, it looks a little bit like New York, but not to the degree you're saying. I was like, right, okay. It feels like to me there's definitely it's a pinch point of some sort.
Let's talk a little bit about the Lokis then themselves. So we've got, in the credits, a Loki, I don't think is a Loki from the comics, Boastful Loki, played by Diobia Oparai, who was in, if I remember rightly, and this won't mean a lot to you because I know you haven't seen the show, but he was in season 5, I think, of Game of Thrones. I think he played Ario Hotai, who's this big guard for one of the families. And he decent actor, but there wasn't much of a character there for him. But anyway, he's got traditional sort of battle armor. He's holding a Mjolnir-esque hammer. The only thing we know is that he's called Boastful Loki from the credits. So we don't know much about him. We've got Kid Loki.
I'm sure we'll find out because I'm sure he'll boast about it.
Well, yeah, probably, yeah. Kid Loki is a major character in the comics. He has his own comic run. He's, interestingly, part of the Young Avengers.
I was going to ask that question. So is that like the Billy Tommy kind of, you know, the kids kind of coming into it?
Yeah.
Kind of thing? Yeah.
So, okay. Yeah, in that they're known as Wiccan and Speed, Wanda's kids.
Right.
You've got Elijah Bradley from The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, the young lad as well, which is interesting. And Kate Bishop, who will be played by Hayley Stansfield in the Hawkeye show.
Right, okay.
Alongside Jeremy Renner. So we're going to see Kate Bishop come in, and the theory is that she will end up being the new Hawkeye, if this is sort of Jeremy Renner's swan song, essentially. So what they could be doing is teeing up a possible Young Avengers project later with this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Kid Loki, anyway, is a big deal for the comics, played by Jack Veal, who was in The End of the Fucking World, the Netflix show.
Right.
So... that's interesting. He is holding Alligator Loki.
Yeah, I didn't see Alligator Loki. When I quickly looked at it, because it goes by in such a flash that I was like,
yeah,
right, okay. And it didn't click about who the voice was until afterwards. I was like, right, I have to go back and look at that.
Yeah.
And it was about the third time I looked at it and went, hang on, what is that?
Is he holding an alligator? So God knows what that's about, but that's going to be bonkers. But the big one I think that made everyone go, ooh, was two things. Firstly, Richard E. Grant.
Yeah.
Great bit of casting. He's great in everything. And he's playing what seems to be classic Loki. Now, this is really interesting in that he is in the garb, the spandex, the horns, going right back to the Jack Kirby Loki from the 1960s comics. So this is the classic, very beginning of Marvel Loki portrayal of an older guy who is incredibly over the top, incredibly ridiculous, incredibly haughty and camp. And I think this is going to be such fun because if they're really going to dig into a little bit of, they found a way to tap into that, like I said earlier, that ridiculous 60s stuff.
Yeah.
and have Richard E. Grant play a completely like ridiculous Loki. I think it's going to be so much fun.
Yeah, and it's the right vessel, isn't it, for something like Loki? Because obviously it has been quite, as I say, dark in some aspects with this particular one. There was a bit of humour at the beginning of the show. But if they are like sort of delving into that kind of atmosphere, then I think that Loki's a good vessel to do it in.
And I'm just looking forward to Tom Hiddleston and Richard E. Grant on screen together. I think they're going to be so much fun opposite each other.
Yeah,
I think they're going to spar in a good way.
You see, that's another thing as well. I didn't know that because there was obviously news that he was going to be playing a character, but no one knew what it was. I didn't know that. So I think that's the one good thing of this show, that I've stayed away from any spoilers, any news, anything like that at all from it, and everything's become as a surprise. It was only after the fact that I found that Richard E. Grant was actually, you know, in the news saying he was playing a character of some sort. So that was really nice to find out at the time.
Yeah. I remembered hearing it ages ago, but I completely forgot about it. So this was a nice, and I didn't know anything about this. So this was a nice ooh moment. All I'd seen all day was everyone on Twitter going, "What?" or "What?" I didn't know the context. I was like, "What the hell is going to happen in this episode?" It's very cool. I mean, I'm guessing this might be Loki, you know, the next episode is Loki putting his band of Lokis together, and they're going to join forces with Sylvie.
Yeah.
And they're going to take down the TVA, surely, in the last two episodes.
Is that where it's going to go, do you reckon? Loki Avengers.
Yeah. Loki puts together his own Avengers. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, maybe.
Is there a Hulk Loki?
We have a Hulk. Can you imagine if that happens? Yeah. That'd be brilliant, wouldn't it?
It would,
cameo. But it's exciting. There's lots to look forward to, Kurt, I think. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah. It is, yeah. And as I say, whether or not we get something, you know, outstanding in the next two episodes, or there's something that you can play off, I'm thinking, when you were talking about Richard E. Grant, I'm thinking potentially something could happen in What If, that, you know, so they could be like pushing that maybe as well. So I think if it doesn't happen in the next two episodes, I'm sure there's enough, you know, in the well to do it in other projects as well. So, yeah, really, really fond. I mean, we're talking about the, you know, getting into the MCU and Marvel as a whole before, that, you know, the wealth of stuff in this phase four that they're trying to like sort of instill into the show, and with a type of thing like the multiverse, is kind of, you know, it's really freed them up. And I think the, you know, Kevin Feige, you know, he's doing all right, isn't the lad? You know, so to be able to like sort of instill something as mad as the multiverse and have people really up for it, you know, and to drip feed it like the way it's been done, I think is a marvel, wonderstruck.
Hey, it's a marvel. There you go. Well, that's how you end a podcast.
Yeah.